it's a pleasure to welcome back author of Zero Hour and editor of Economy and Markets. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris. Last week, the Fed head, Jerome Powell, surprised the markets a bit. The Fed funds futures collapsed at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. We were expecting a rate hike no sooner than December, January, this year, next year. And, of course, now it looks like July. There's a much higher probability that we will see a rate cut, okay? Perhaps the beginning of a new rate cut cycle. What are the implications of lower rates for the markets?
What it says to the markets, on one hand, even the Fed thinks and acknowledges the economy slowing globally, which it is outside the United States, and even we're maybe already slowing a bit after the tax cut hit. On the other hand, lower rates, short-term and even more so long-term, and the long-term treasuries have come down. That's way more important for the stock market because stock valuations are basically earnings forecasts discounted by the 10-year treasury bond rate. So the lower that rate is, the more those future earnings forecasts are worth. So it goes both ways. But to me, right now, the fact that this is looking to go from tightening back to neutral to stimulative, the markets like that. And I've been saying, for many months now, and started as soon as Trump got elected because of the tax cut potential, that, hey, this final wave of this bubble looks like it's going to last longer. And I'm expecting that the NASDAQ could go to 10,000 by late this year, early next year. The Dow could go to 33,000 or, something like that. So I think we're in a blow-off bubble. And I think for the markets, it's the perfect scenario here. The world is definitely slowing, but China's stimulating because of that a bit. Europe, more than a bit. Europe, a bit. They're going more from tightening a bit to accommodative again. We're looking at going accommodative. So the economy's slowing just enough to get central banks to be accommodative, and that's enough for the markets. The markets, as long as we don't get in a war with Iran, which is still a possibility in some level, and the China trade deal comes through sometime, and I'm still skeptical because I think they want world domination, not a deal here. Markets, I think, will go up, but ultimately, if they're having to cut because the economy keeps slowing, especially into next year, if the economy's slowing into next year with all the stimulus, that is not a good sign to me. And I do expect that the markets are going to peak by early next year and start to crash. And if that happens, it's bad for Trump.
This is unprecedented. As you know, the Fed did not wring the liquidity out of the system. That's really one of the first times I can recall where such an enormous amount of quantitative easing-like operations, and there's still almost $4 trillion on their balance sheet, again, citing the St. Louis Fed's numbers. And we're two of not many voices on this show that believe that the Fed, their new change in stance, it's good news for the economy. And you have to admit, our POTUS really cajoled the Fed head, saying, look, we need to cut rates. I want to see a 1% rate cut. I can't remember any time where, a president actually stood up to a standing Fed chairman. These rates need to go down on a specific target. And the markets like that, right? Because rightly or wrongly, it says, hey, we've got major leadership. He's going to give us more candy. Of course, long term, as soon as they find out they can put elected officials into place that will give them free goodies, it's the beginning of the end.
It is unprecedented that there be, it's literally globally, you're talking $12 to $13 trillion of money creation with all central banks. Say it's closer to four at peak for the Fed. And this has never happened except in World War II and not even to this degree for anywhere near this length. This is unprecedented for central banks to say, we are not going to liquidate a debt bubble or a financial asset bubble. We're gonna stop a depression, a deleveraging from happening at all costs, as Mario Draghi was the first one to say, I will print any amount of money to keep people from shorting government bonds and keep this economy going. This long term, this is the worst thing you can do, that the relative amount is much greater now because it's been more and for a longer period of time. The difference is World War II was a true emergency. We're fighting a war and having to issue massive amounts of treasury bonds to fund it. And with the inflationary aspects of war, and war is inflationary, those bonds would have cost the government a fortune. So they did do quantitative easing. Their biggest motive was to push down the rates on the bonds they're having to finance long-term debt with to fight the war. This time, they're doing the same thing. They're pushing down the rates. The pushing down the rates on long-term bonds is much more important than the short-term rates being set at zero. A lot of bonds, government bonds and high-quality bonds around the world are negative adjusted for inflation, and other ones like the Treasury got down to zero adjusted for inflation. That's long-term free money. That means companies buy back their stocks cheaply. Earnings per share has gone up 119% faster than actual earnings for corporations, and that's why stocks are 120% overvalued from what my spending wave says they should be right now. So we have this stock market on crack from free money and leverage and stock buybacks and lower T-bond rates to make the earnings more valuable. Everything's working in their favor, while mainstream, this recovery's averaged 2%. This recovery's no strong, well, from the top in 2007, and this is a great comparison, through 2018, which is the top in 29 to 1940, 11 years, cumulative GDP only went up 19% in this recovery versus 20% back in the Great Depression. We have already had the lowest real GDP growth rates in history in the last 11 years, even with massive stimulus. Imagine how much it would have been much lower and how much inflation we would have seen without it. Totally unprecedented in non-wartime history, and even World War II was unprecedented. We never had to finance a war that big. World War I, we didn't see nearly as much money printing.
We also saw technological explosion, right? Revolution. Everything radar led to microwave ovens and MRI technology, and of course, we also had a nuclear, rightly or wrongly, whether you like it or not, a nuclear revolution that brought enormous energy, especially to Europe and the United States and now China. Even though nobody thinks fondly of the period, incredible benefits to society, which boosted the economy in ways that are very difficult, I think, to quantify. Looking at today, we have, you know, last week's Fed Beige Book report last Wednesday showed the economy moderate for the most part from April to mid-May. Growth is held in check, of course, by some labor shortages. And the big thing, tariffs and more saber rattling now towards our southern neighbor. Really extended tariffs to virtually every country. We have put substantial tariffs on Canada's lumber, our imports for our housing market on Canada. We're now threatening Mexico and, of course, the $200 billion levying, of course, tariffs and other trade barriers on our largest trading partner and the second global powerhouse economically, China. What are the threats and risks to the markets over this trade war? Or do you agree with some of our other guests that think it's a non sequitur?
The Roaring Twenties bubble and burst, the greatest in history, saw very similar things. The first thing they did was start to restrict immigration in a high immigration era. Restricting immigration, whether you like immigrants or not, is not the issue. Demographically, it's a negative. Less people coming in, less people working, contributing, paying taxes, spending, all this stuff. And then trade wars, and you know, right in the late stages of the boom and the early stages of the bust, trade wars, which just create a more limited pie, a shrinking pie, and basically hurt everybody in the end, even though it may favor some countries at first to others. This is the same stuff, but the biggest thing, Chris, no bigger trend than this is the greatest, most global, most pervasive bubble, which means it's been in commodities, which have already burst, real estate, which is yet to burst for the second time, stocks yet to burst now for the third time. The greatest bubble in history has been created by all this stimulus and a lot of natural trends like demographics and debts. But a lot behind this, and bubbles only burst. And when they burst, you can only keep them from bursting so long. And this has been heroic. When they burst, it ends very badly. The typical bubble burst crash for stocks is 70 to 90%. And 1929 to 32 was 89% for blue chip stocks like the Dow.
Those are some absolutely remarkable numbers for the typical portfolio investor. Pretty solid. Okay, let's move on to the housing market. You know, the Case-Shiller certainly seems to indicate an echo housing boom. We're seeing, I believe, numbers now that are even in excess of the 2006-2007. You see new housing starts. That's a solid indicator of strength. It remains robust. We saw new housing starts turn over, roll over ahead of the housing bust in 2006-2007, and we're not seeing that this time. And so I'd like to know where you think we are in the housing cycle.
I forecast Japan's bubble burst in stocks and housing in late 80s when no thought they were going to take over the world. That's why I don't like coincident indicators. Everything looks great at the top, including housing in most cases and stuff, or any statistics. But basically, Japan crashed and then never bounced 28 years later after the peak. Never. When the next generation came along, not as big as their baby boom, which came ahead of ours. And I realized people are dying faster than young people are coming along buying for the first time in history. So I changed my real estate indicators to what I call net demand. Well, who are the peak buyers? How are they growing versus the dyers who are sellers? And you know what? This boom has only come up a little higher than the last bubble. So people say, well, that's not that overvalued and the economy's stronger. But compared to this net demand, much lower now here and around the world. Housing was overvalued 21% in 2006 up, and it's overvalued 42% now. I'm seeing a 40 to 50% crash in the next several years. So a bigger crash than we saw in the Great Recession. And housing may be the last to peak here, but it will go down, and it is more overvalued than it looks because you have to look at under the hood. Real demand for housing is much lower than it used to be. It's only the super low interest rate and another bubble where people think you can't lose, you got to be in this bubble, causing this to go up. This is going to end worse than the last bubble in housing.
What will be the panacea that our Fed officials, I mean, we've seen their playbook, okay? We saw it in 2006, 2007. They came up with some unique methods all around the world, coordinated efforts of multiple central banks and institutions. Key money center lending banks and institutions, a real coordinated effort. And this time, you know, you wonder what's going to be their go-to method. I mean, they've got $18 trillion were required to keep the entire system from freezing up in an epic credit crisis, the likes of which we haven't seen arguably since 1930.
Well, they're just going to keep stimulating. They're going to keep creating a bubble. They can't create, demand's only going up because of the wealth factor, not because of demographic trends. Debt has never been deleveraged, so it's still weighing on everybody in the economy and stuff. So they're just going to go, they blow. And the problem is once it blows, one of the other things I've researched in the last several years, Chris, is that when a bubble peaks in stocks, now there's, I can give you other example, but in stocks, the first crash is 41% on average in the first 2.5 months. A typical bubble crash is 70-90% for stocks, so let's call it 80 on average. Half of that's going to happen in the first 2 to 3 months, and people are stunned. They sell and they panic, and there's a bounce off of that when the smart money buys in, and then you get this 2 to 3 year 80% downtrend. It is brutal. My problem is next time things go bad, the crash is going to be steeper and harder than it was in 2008. And even back then, the central banks were late to react. The stock market was already down 54%. We'd already seen a recession of 10 to 11% unemployment, the worst since the Great Depression and similar to 1982 with 83. We'd already seen heavy damage, but they reacted big. But now they've blown most of their powder. They can't react as much. And I think this next one will happen harder and faster. And they will lose confidence because people will see, oh, wait a minute. Last time this happened, they printed a bunch of money and things got better for a while, although anemically. Here we are now looking worse than 2008. And 2008 looked exactly, as you said earlier, like 1930. It would have been a Great Depression if they hadn't have printed $12 trillion.
Why don't you give us your outlook on the precious metals? Are you looking for a crack-up boom, first the deflation, then the inflation? Or are we going to have something a bit more complex this time? And what does that mean for our precious metals aficionados?
I think, you know, We had a little bit of deflation last time, but the money printing offset that. And then gold, of course, rallied the most with the money printing because the assumption was trillions of dollars of money printing. If this doesn't cause inflation, it won't. What won't? Gold is the ultimate inflation hedge, the best in all of history, and that's why it did so well in the 1970s crisis. The economy sucked, but inflation was high, and gold did incredibly well. This is, I think we get, in the next downturn, we get deeper deflation. That hurts gold at first. Gold, by the way, though, Chris, because I have, you know, monitored all the commodities and in the commodity bubble, gold and Bitcoin have been the only two things you can invest in that realm. Bitcoin doesn't quite count, but it's still similar, that have not gone down as much as the other bubbles. It bubbled up as much, gold did, as the commodities or more, has not corrected as much. So it's showing gold has more strength in the commodity sector. I used to say gold could go to 450 to 700. I'm saying 1,000 now. I think it's going to go down in the next downturn, but it could be as little as 1,000, as much as 700. And then gold's going to be one of the leading commodities in the next long-term commodity boom from 2020 to 38. So right now, gold has, I think, some more upside, if anything, in the early stages of the downturn. It may outperform like it did in 2008, but when the downturn gets bad, deflation sets in.
Go back to 2008, 2009. You might recall, you know, stocks were plunging 20, 30% or more. Most everything except for treasuries, T-bills, especially T-bonds, they were soaring. But virtually every asset was in free fall. And gold, you know, it essentially treaded water, kind of held its own. It bounced, as you said, you know, kind of sideways, and then it really took off. And that seems to mirror or echo some of your sentiments today.
33% in silver, 50%. At the worst of the crisis, you're right, it actually went sideways to up, which was way better than everything else going down. And then when the money printing happened on the side, and of course there's going to be inflation to a lesser degree on the other side of this crash, then of course gold will do well. So gold's, if I had to be in a commodity, I'd be in gold. I still think gold has limited upside. I think 1525 is the ultimate resistance because that's where it really broke down when people first realized that money printing was escalating up and inflation was still not responding, and that's when gold finally cracked in early 2013. But gold has held up the best in the commodity sector, and I think the next commodity boom after this crash is going to be stronger than ever because emerging countries are going to dominate. You know, the two biggest consumers of gold in the world and way out distancing investment, central banks, everything else, China and India, and they're gonna be the next economy.
Don't forget Russia, too. Russia is accumulating. I think you could make the case that gold is the true only free lunch. If you think of investing from a purely scientific, very few assets have a negative correlation that even come close to gold. I mean, I challenge you to find a bond fund that's even negatively correlated to U.S. equities. So it has that unique characteristic, and I'd also throw in there just a modicum, 1% or 2% in the cryptos, because they also have some unique correlation aspects. Why don't you tell people more about your books and your newsletter and what else they can find when they bookmark your website?
The best way, you know, to get to know us, our economy and markets is free. You just go to harrydent.com, put in your email, and you're on. And then you can listen to us. It's a daily newsletter. We have monthly newsletters and higher-level newsletters, investment services. But, you know, get to know us first, and you can do that for free. So the best thing to do is just go to harrydent.com, get on our newsletter. 0 Hour is our latest book, and I'm looking at releasing my next book probably around the turn of next year, right, somewhere between late this year and early next year. I'm not going to even go to a publisher on this one, Chris, because we got to release it right when it's happening. Because remember, that first crash, 42% in the first 2.5 months. We want to catch that.
Can you tell people about your services?
Go to harrydent.com and get on our newsletter. Economy and Markets is our free newsletter. We have some paid newsletters, but the best thing, get on our Economy and Markets. You just put in your email and you're on our free newsletter. You can get to know them.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Show.
shopping for fine jewelry just got easier, GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Many Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share, with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Many Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Many Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Many Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange, and in the US, MENEF. Remember to sign up to Many's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Many Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click.
Vault Chain
offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.